hard to believe there was a war going on. Her presence there at the pond, in the middle of nowhere, was the only proof that there was. When they came back inside the cottage, Emmy and Julia went upstairs to unpack and put their clothes away. Charlotte told them that for this first night they could relax in their room while she prepared supper downstairs, and that tomorrow the three of them would sit down and decide who would do what chores. As Emmy hung up one of Julia's dresses, her sister asked what Charlotte had meant by that. "I imagine she expects we will do our fair share here, setting the table, clearing it, taking out the rubbish, that sort of thing."
"Do you think she will let me feed the chickens?"
Emmy slid the hanger onto the rung inside the wardrobe. "I am sure she will. Hand me your jumper." Julia handed the sweater to her and snapped her suitcase closed.
"It's not as bad here as I thought it would be. Aunt Charlotte's nice. And the house smells pretty."
"Pretty isn't a smell, Jules. Slide your suitcase under your bed like I did with mine, so you won't trip over it."
"Why don't you want to call her Aunt Charlotte?"
Julia asked as she pushed the suitcase past the bedskirt. "I'm too old to call someone aunt who is not my aunt. But you're young. It's fine for you." Julia rose from her knees and sat heavily on her bed.
"What are we supposed to do now?"
Emmy closed the wardrobe door. "What would you like to do?"
"Can I look at the brides?"
"Not now."
"Why?"
Emmy didn't have a good reason other than she was tired, and it was near the end of a very trying day.
"Maybe later.
Why don't you write a letter to Mum instead? You can tell her all about the ducks and turtles."
"All right, but I'll need help with the big words."
Emmy told Julia she would help her with any word she didn't know how to spell. She opened the desk drawer. Inside, Emmy found three different shades of writing paper, several sharpened pencils, and a fountain pen. It was exciting to think that she now had plenty of paper to continue sketching dresses. Emmy had planned to buy some drawing paper with her first month's pay, but specialty paper was also being rationed and thus becoming harder to find. She decided she would make it a goal, starting the next day, to sketch a new gown every week so that she would have something to look forward to. For the moment, though, Emmy withdrew two pieces of paper, one for each of them, a pencil for Julia and the fountain pen for herself, to write letters. Emmy let Julia have the desk while she sat on her bed with Julia's fairy tale book on her lap for a writing surface. While Julia wrote about the train ride, the dead bird in the street, the yellow bedroom, Charlotte's and Rose's long braids, and their lovely garden, Emmy penned a letter too. "Dear Mrs. Crofton, my sister and I are staying with an older woman named Charlotte Havelock, in a tiny place not far from Stow-in-the-Wold, in Gloucestershire. I would be very much in your debt if you could let me know when your cousin returns to London, so that I might meet with him as we planned. I will continue to work on new sketches, and I will ask Mrs. Havelock if she has a sewing machine that I can practice on while I'm here. I hope to see you again very soon, and I trust you will be safe. Yours truly, Emmeline Downtree. Thistle House, 3 Morgesbury Road. Stow-in-the-Wold, Gloucestershire. P.S. I still have the back door key you gave me." They were called to supper just as Emmy was finishing addressing their letters. She brought the envelopes downstairs to be posted in the morning. Charlotte had set the table in the dining room for their first meal, to mark the occasion. When Emmy asked about how to post the letters, Charlotte seemed pleased that the girls had been upstairs writing home.
"Your mum will be glad to hear from you girls,"
she said as she placed a dish of parsley potatoes on the table, and motioned for them to choose chairs. Rose, already seated, was unfolding and refolding her napkin.
"Emmy didn't write, Mum. Only me,"
Julia announced as she plopped onto a chair. Charlotte raised her head slightly to look at the two envelopes in Emmy's hand, surely wondering to whom Emmy had written.
"We can post your letters tomorrow. Perhaps we can walk to town and do that. It's only 1/2 mile. Be good to stretch your legs."
"I need new wellies,"
Rose announced, not looking up from her folding. "Your willies are in fine shape, Rose, but we'd love for you to come with us. Emmeline, dear, please do have a seat." Emmy took the chair next to Julia, while Charlotte brought in a plate of sliced ham, something the sisters hadn't seen since Christmas. When Charlotte was seated as well, she held her hands out to her sister, and to Emmy on her other side. "Shall we thank God for your safe arrival?" It had been a long time since Emmy and Julia had been in the same room with someone who spoke to God out of reverence. She took her sister's other hand and bowed her head, peering at Julia to see whether she was doing the same. Charlotte's prayer was brief and to the point. She thanked God for the girls, asked that they and everyone they loved would be kept safe during this uncertain time, and that they all would be always thankful for God's gracious provision. While they ate, Julia chattered about what their flat was like in London, the long-ago trip to Brighton Beach, and how much she hated the air raid sirens. Emmy let her carry the conversation, which Charlotte and Rose seemed to enjoy very much, leading her to believe the two elderly sisters had little exposure to the animated prattle of a child. After the girls helped with the dishes, the four of them settled in the parlor to look at Charlotte's family photographs. Night fell. Charlotte switched on several lamps and pulled the blackout curtains down, shutting out a sky full of stars. Chapter 12. Despite the lovely room, Emmy had trouble getting to sleep that first night at Thistle House. She had gone to bed when Julia did, though she could have stayed up later with Charlotte and Rose if she had wanted. Julia had grown pensive as they looked at Charlotte's and Rose's family pictures. For the first time since they had been notified of the evacuation, it seemed as if Julia understood more fully that she and Emmy had been sent away because London was not safe. That meant Mum was not safe. She did not want to go to bed alone in a strange house with such heavy thoughts. Emmy pulled the curtains open when she turned out the light so that the bright moon, which had become London's enemy in recent months, could bathe the room in lustrous half-light and keep away the deepest dark. She had sat on the edge of Julia's bed and stroked her back to lull her to sleep, but it was a long time before her sister stopped asking questions such as, "Why didn't Mum come with us on the train? Why isn't she here with us? What if the Germans come to London?" and closed her eyes. When Julia was at last asleep and Emmy was finally in bed, she had her own troubles to keep sleep elusive, primarily the loss of her job, the meeting with Mr. Dabney that she did not want to miss, and the notion that Mum had willingly chosen to bear all the responsibility of raising her. The more Emmy thought about it, the more she understood what she had simply failed to notice before. What kind of man would 16-year-old Mum have agreed to leave unnamed on a birth certificate? A man who didn't want to be charged with statutory rape, that was who. And how else could this man have secured Mum's silence, unless money had been involved? Surely that was how she had financed those first few years of her life as a single mother. There had been a payoff. That was how she was able to stay in London with a new baby, instead of moving with her mother to Devonshire. How long had the money lasted? Emmy wondered. Because at some point, Mum had met Neville, and she had let herself get pregnant again. But this time she was 24. Since she would not be paid off, perhaps she was hoping she could at last be married off. The trouble was, Neville hadn't had a keen sense of responsibility. A pregnant girlfriend wasn't exactly a problem, and it certainly wasn't his problem. Mum had been wrong about herself, too, because she fell in love with a man who fathered her second child, but didn't want to marry her. And when that happened, it didn't matter that Neville had lots of money one day and nothing the next, or that he had no scruples. She was in love with him until the day he left her for good. Love had not worked out like Mum had hoped. Love had failed her, but money had not. Was that what she had returned to then? Was that why they had moved to a nicer flat than a kitchen maid could afford after Neville left? was that where they had warm beds, hot water, enough food to eat, and suitcases to pack their clothes in for the evacuation? Because someone was giving her money on the side? And what else could it be for but for sex? Mum didn't have anything else to offer but her lovely body. Emmy sat up in bed, both repulsed and heartbroken by what her mother had become. For several long minutes she sat there, drawing breaths in and letting them out, as she sought to calm her thundering heart. She swung her legs over the side of the bed and reached underneath it for her bride's box. Emmy opened the latch and withdrew the sketches, laying them across her rumpled blanket, now awash in moonlight. A translucent glow draped the gowns, with the sweet white radiance due them, such that each one seemed touched by magic for just that moment. It did not matter that there were no faces on the penciled-in heads. The gowns themselves exuded elation and perfection, exactly what you would expect a bride to radiate on the day of her dreams, on the day everything was right in her world. No wonder Emmy loved these dresses so. Each one was an emblem of all that she wanted for her miserable life. Emmy didn't hear Julia rise from her bed, nor did she feel the tears on her own cheeks. Her sister was just suddenly at her side, crawling up next to her and laying her head on Emmy's shoulder. Julia's small arm curled around her sister's back, and Emmy lowered her head to Julia's.
"I miss Mum too," Julia whispered.
The next day over breakfast, Charlotte made a list of the girls' chores so that they would feel Thistle House was their home. Guests didn't do chores, Charlotte said, and she didn't want the girls to feel like guests, nor did she want them to get bored. School would not be in session until September, which meant they had nearly 3 months to occupy themselves. Emmy couldn't quite grasp the idea that she would still be with Charlotte come September, but she said nothing. Julia got her wish to be able to feed the chickens, and to water them, change their straw, and gather eggs. Emmy would take care of their laundry, bedding, and towels, and she would do the sweeping and run the Hoover. Rose, sitting at the table while the chores were divvied up, and wanting to be a part of the conversation, was placed in charge of using the feather duster, although Emmy did not think she would actually remember that she had asked for a chore to do. The sisters would take turns setting and clearing the table, and drying the dishes. The vegetable garden and fruit trees were best kept by all four of them, Charlotte said, since both required constant vigilance against weeds and pests and inclement weather, and because the gardens and fruit trees might be what kept them all fed if rationing continued to become more strict. Butter, bacon, and sugar had been rationed since the beginning of the year, and meat, cheese, and fruit had followed not long after, when fewer and fewer supply ships could get past the German U-boats patrolling the English Channel. No one in London had a garden the size of Charlotte's. It was amazing to think that here in the country, a ration book didn't determine what you ate or didn't eat, but rather the state of your vegetable garden and hen house. Charlotte also decreed that Julia and Emmy should read a book every week to keep their minds fresh, and that they should write Mum twice a month, or as long as the stationery held out. Paper had also recently been rationed, Charlotte said, and Emmy could not help frown at this. She could afford no reject gowns if the writing paper was to last. And while Charlotte had ample books in her sitting room, Emmy doubted she had let her tear out the blank pages in back to sketch bridal gowns. The four of them walked into town after lunch to post the letters, stop at the library so that the girls could check out books for the first week, and to buy meat, dried beans, and other staples Charlotte could not grow in her garden. The townspeople on the streets, and in the stores, regarded Emmy and her sister with friendly but wary smiles. It was obvious no one knew what to expect next. If the evacuation was complete, and all the children were safely out of London, then what could possibly follow but the brutal attack everyone feared? Two of the women Charlotte introduced them to told the girls that their sons were far away fighting hard so that they could be reunited with their mom and dad. It was as if they needed the girls to know that although they couldn't see the war there in the Cotswolds, they could still feel it. There were other London evacuees in the village, not just from their train, but from others as well. Just as she was about to enter the library, Emmy saw two evacuees she recognized, a sister and a brother from their train car. Their eyes met from across the street, and an unspoken communication passed between them. Somehow, in that wordless exchange, they were able to ascertain that neither of them had been taken in by a lunatic or a tyrant. The woman they were with was younger than Charlotte, and held the hand of a little boy who was clearly hers. Emmy was glad in that moment that she and Julia didn't have to compete for attention from a foster mother's own child. At the post office, Charlotte introduced them to the postmistress, easily the tallest woman Emmy had ever seen. She handed her the letters, and the postmistress accepted them with a confident nod, saying it took only 2 days for mail to reach London. As the letter to Mrs. Crofton passed from Emmy's hand, she unashamedly prayed for God's favor. She knew how selfish it was to ask for something so self-serving as an appointment with a dressmaker in light of the war. But she also knew the war could not last forever. One day it would be over, and they would all be able to go back to doing what they had been doing before, dreaming what they had been dreaming, and planning what they had been planning. Emmy was already plotting how she would be able to sneak away unnoticed back to London. That daunting process had to begin with receiving Mrs. Crofton's letter of response, and without Charlotte's asking about it. And she could not begin the journey there, in Stowe, where someone would recognize her. She would need to get herself to Morton, where she would attract far less attention. After leaving the post office, Charlotte stopped for a copy of the Daily Mail, which she said she liked to pick up every other day or so. Emmy quickly offered to add to her list of duties, walking to town to get it for her. A trip to town away from watchful eyes would allow Emmy to post as many letters to Mrs. Crofton as she needed to, without drawing attention to it. Charlotte seemed to think that the London newspaper might seem like a small tether to Emmy's real home. She also had no reason to mistrust Emmy's motives. "Of course," she said. The last stop before returning home was a variety store. While they waited outside with Rose and their armload of library books, Charlotte went inside for Epsom salts and a bottle of aspirin. She emerged a few minutes later with those items, plus several strange-looking pencils and 10 sheets of cardstock. "So that you can keep drawing your bridal dresses." Charlotte handed the paper and the pencils to Emmy. "The pencils are special for sketching. They're what artists use, and they're supposed to be just what you need." It took Emmy a second to find her voice. "Thank you," she muttered, surprise making her gratitude sound half-hearted. Julia stared at the pencils and the tissue-wrapped paper, and then turned to Charlotte with an unmistakable, "What about me?" look. Charlotte tousled her hair. "I have something for you back at the house, Julia."
"Really? What is it?"
"Let's go home, and I'll show you." Julia brightened and happily took Charlotte's hand. As the two of them walked ahead, Rose fell in step with Emmy. They hadn't taken more than a few steps when Emmy felt Rose's hand in hers. Back at the house, Julia could scarcely wait until what they had brought home with them was put away.
"Just let me get Rose settled with her tea, and then I'll show you,"
Charlotte said as she put the kettle on. Emmy took the drawing paper and pencils to her room and laid them on top of the bride's box on the bedside table. Back downstairs, she got out the cream and sugar, while Charlotte poured Rose's tea and placed the hot kettle in the tea cozy. She handed Emmy 2 digestive biscuits.
"Give those to Rose, will you, dear?"
she said to Emmy, then turned to Julia.
"All right. Let me get a torch."
Charlotte grabbed a flashlight from the shelf near the back door and then headed out of the kitchen.
"Come along, Miss Julia."
Julia skipped after her. Emmy brought the biscuits to Rose, and the two of them watched as Charlotte and Julia left the room.
"Where are they going?"
Rose said, her brow furrowed.
"I don't know." I don't want them going in my room. They shouldn't be going into my room. It's my room.
Emmy could hear Charlotte and Julia on the stairs. So could Rose.
It's my room, my things.
Rose didn't sound agitated, and she made no move to rise from her chair. Hers was the weirdest opposition Emmy had ever seen. Resistance without effort. Emmy's own interest in what Charlotte was planning to give Julia was also piqued, and not just because of Rose. She turned to the older woman.
"Want me to go and see what they're doing?"
Emmy asked. Rose picked up her cup daintily.
"For heaven's sake, yes, it's my room and my things."
Happy to oblige, Emmy made for the stairs. But Charlotte and Julia were headed into the yellow room, not Rose's. Charlotte turned to Emmy when she appeared behind them, happy, it seemed, that Emmy had followed them. "Rose wanted to make sure you weren't traipsing about in her room," Emmy volunteered. Charlotte just smiled. She turned back to face the far wall and the desk. She lifted the lace tablecloth off the waist-high table next to it, revealing a crawlspace door between the wooden legs. Charlotte sank to her knees and clicked on the flashlight.
"Been a while since I've had any need to root about in here. Want to make sure no spiders or such have taken up residence."
The door protested as she opened it, the hinges squeaking at the disturbance. She bent forward and poked her head in the space, shining the flashlight about.
"Hmm," she said. "Fancy that. Just a few cobwebs."
She pulled her head back out.
"Julia, you're young and small. Could you crawl inside and hand me the box with the pictures of canning jars on the sides? And then the bigger one underneath. I promise neither one is very heavy."
Julia didn't need to be asked twice. Charlotte moved out of the way, and Julia dropped to her knees. Charlotte handed her the flashlight, and then Julia scooted inside the crawlspace and disappeared inside it. Emmy heard scraping on wood, and then the first box appeared. And then the second one.
"There's a box of books in here,"
Julia called out.
"They're just old school books. They can stay,"
Charlotte said, brushing her hand across the dusty surface of the first box. Motes took to the beams of afternoon sunlight slanting in the room. Julia reappeared, her long blonde hair mussed about her face.
"Well done, Julia,"
Charlotte said, as Julia crawled completely out, and Charlotte swung the door closed. She took the flashlight from Julia and switched it off.
"What's in them?"
Julia asked, fully intrigued. Charlotte smiled and opened the first box. Inside were little lumps of thin muslin. Charlotte withdrew one of the lumps. Inside the fabric was a child-sized china teacup, patterned in autumn leaves.
"Oh!"
Julia exclaimed.
"It's my tea set from when I was a little girl. I want you to think of it as yours, for as long as you're here, all right?"
Julia was speechless with wonder, as Charlotte continued to unwrap the pieces. There were four cups with their saucers, four plates, a creamer and sugar bowl, and a squat little teapot with a swan-like spout. Then Charlotte opened the next box, which held two dolls, one golden-haired and one brunette, and a smaller box of tissue-wrapped doll clothes. She placed the dolls in Julia's arms.
"This one with the brown hair, I called Guinevere, and the other one Henrietta, but you can call them whatever you want. They are also yours to play with while you're here, but I want you to take good care of them, no leaving them outside, or tearing the clothes, or bringing them to the table. Can you do that?"
Julia nodded solemnly, astonishment in her eyes.
"I promise,"
she whispered. She pulled the dolls close to her chest and kissed each head.
"I love their names, Aunt Charlotte."
Charlotte got to her feet and picked up the smaller box, with the unwrapped tea service resting at odd angles inside it.
"I'll just wash the tea set, and then it will be ready for you to use. That sound all right?"
Julia nodded, enraptured beyond words. It was the happiest Emmy had ever seen her. She sought Charlotte's gaze. Thank you for doing that, Emmy said softly. I've something to show you, too. Emmy followed Charlotte to her room across the hall. The woman set the box with the tea set on her bed and walked to a wardrobe. After opening the door, she reached for a long, deep box on a shelf above the rod of hanging dresses and blouses. This box Charlotte also set on her bed. She lifted its lid, pushed away the tissue paper, and pulled out an ivory gown, its skirt glistening with tiny seed pearls that had aged to twilight gray. Lacy sleeves that buttoned tight to the elbow ballooned to the shoulder in Victorian elegance. A close-fitting bodice completed the top half, and the crushed full skirt hinted at the gown's former glory. My wedding dress, Charlotte murmured, gazing at the gown, not at Emmy. It's beautiful. She turned to Emmy. I thought it might inspire you. Sometimes an old design will spark a new idea. You can take it apart if you want, if it helps you. Emmy touched the fabric, a low luster satin that nearly murmured hello back to her. I couldn't do such a thing, she whispered. It is of no use to anyone sitting in a box, Charlotte continued. It's no longer in style, and I have no daughter to give it to. Wouldn't it make more sense for you to take it apart and study the construction? You could use the parts to reinvent it, or come up with your own design. Not just a drawing, but an actual dress. You would let me do that? Emmy was incredulous. It would make me very happy if you did. Now, I don't have a sewing machine, but I've sharp scissors, several spools of white thread, and lots of sewing needles. You'll have to do it all by hand, but I'm thinking you're probably going to have the time during these long summer months. Emmy, like Julia, found she could not express the right words of gratitude. To say a simple thank you to such generosity seemed too shallow. So she thought of something else to say. Would you like to see my sketches? For the next few minutes, while Julia played with Guinevere and Henrietta in the other room, Charlotte and Emmy sat on the bed and looked at the sketches in the bride's box. Charlotte said they were the loveliest dresses she had ever seen. A day that could not have been more surprisingly pleasant for Emmy and Julia became even more so. Late in the afternoon, when it was time to take care of the chickens, a gentle rain started to fall. Charlotte let Julia use her umbrella, a red polka-dot umbrella with a curly black handle that looked like licorice. Chapter 13. The days at Thistle House fell into a routine, as days always do. After the beds were made and breakfast things put away, mornings were spent tending the vegetable garden, weeding the berry patch, pinching off the heads of spent blooms, and watering the flower beds and the apple, plum, and pear trees, of which there were several each. Even though being outside made the girls hot and sweaty, it was Julia's favorite part of the day, and the work made the morning fly by. After lunch on Mondays and Fridays, Emmy would walk to town to buy Charlotte a newspaper. The afternoons were spent inside reading, working on puzzles, or writing to Mum. Late afternoon tea was often enjoyed at one of the neighbors' homes. All of the neighbors seemed to be Charlotte's age or older. Julia and Emmy were the only children among Charlotte's friends, and that they were London evacuees made them especially interesting. In the evenings, after listening to the BBC for a bit, Charlotte and Rose would knit. Julia would play with the dolls or the tea set, or both, and Emmy would work on dissecting Charlotte's wedding dress, her favorite part of the day. Some days, Charlotte loaded everyone into her blue jalopy, and they headed to Morton or Cheltenham to see Rose's doctor or to shop in stores that had more in the way of staples to offer, though the queues were longer. On Sundays, they attended services at the church with the blue door that Charlotte had pointed out the day they arrived. Emmy liked the vicar well enough, and she enjoyed the way their voices echoed when they sang hymns or recited the creed and prayers. The stone floors and walls made the sound bigger than it really was. and more eloquent. Church was also one of the few places where they saw the other London children, all at the same time. They, like the girls, seemed to have settled into their new surroundings. Emmy felt no need to converse with these other children, but she was a bit surprised that they didn't either, even though most were younger. It was as if they had all struck a careful balance between where they lived now and where their true homes were. To speak to one another was to trifle with that balance. Emmy had summoned the courage and snipped away every seam of Charlotte's wedding dress, a process that took her nearly a week. She then laid out the pieces so that she could study their structure, and also compare them with the bride's box sketches. Some nights Charlotte would sit with her while she worked, and sometimes Rose would, which was always a bit unnerving, as Rose was convinced the dress in pieces was for her wedding, and she worried Emmy wouldn't get it sewn in time. Mum's first letter came at the end of June, nearly 2 weeks after they had arrived at Stowe. She wrote that she missed her daughters, that the entire city seemed out of sorts without its children, and that there had been annoying air raid warnings nearly every night since the girls had left. Emmy didn't think this was quite true. She read the newspaper that Charlotte had her by. The rest of June had been relatively quiet in London. Julia and Emmy had left 1 week after Mr. Churchill announced on the radio that Britain would fight the Germans on every beach, street, hill, and field, and never, ever surrender to them. That had been as near an invitation to Hitler to come see if Britain would do just that as anyone could have given. And yet the attack on London did not come. The few bombs that had fallen in the open country, like those at Addington and Colney, had been so insignificant and so far from the city centre, some wondered if London wasn't the safest place after all. There were no landing fields to strafe, no troops to engage, no planes to shoot down. London was a city of civilians, shopkeepers, firemen, watchers, and mothers without their children. But the girls wrote Mum back and told her they missed her too, to keep the blackout curtains pulled tight, and to mind the sirens. Only one letter came from Mrs. Crofton, in late June, which Emmy read as she walked to town and then hid inside her pocket. Mrs. Crofton had heard again from her cousin. He was much intrigued by the two sketches she had sent him, and he had an idea he wanted to run past Mrs. Crofton when he returned to London, which probably wouldn't be until sometime in August. She didn't know what the idea was, or even if it had to do with Emmy, but she thought it might. She also wrote that she missed having Emmy at the shop, and that business was dreadfully slow. Emmy wrote her straight away, posting the letter at the post office before she walked back to Thistle House. She wrote that she missed her job at Primrose Bridal, and that she was keeping up with her sewing skills by hand. In mid-July, Charlotte planted a winter squash garden, something she had wanted to do for several years, but hadn't because she hadn't known what she would do with so great a harvest. Now there would be plenty of people in the cities to whom she could give the squash, if they had more than they would need. They also moved tomato plants that Charlotte had started in May into the main vegetable patch and harvested the early potatoes, beets, and carrots. One day in late July, Charlotte brought home from the fabric store in Morton a bolt of checked muslin that had been stained and that the owner of the store could not sell. It wasn't the entire bolt. The flaw hadn't shown up until the owner had already sold half of the yardage. But it was more than enough for Emmy to try her hand at making her own pattern pieces. It didn't matter if she made a mistake and cut pieces she could not use. Charlotte had acquired it for next to nothing, because the owner was a close friend. It was slow going, sewing everything by hand, but Emmy found she made fewer mistakes than when she was using Mrs. Crofton's impressive singer. And she sketched two new dresses in July, one based on the basic design of Charlotte's dress, and another on one of the doll's ball gowns. As the days leaned into August, Emmy found herself feeling sad that she would have to sneak away from Thistle House to meet with Mrs. Crofton's cousin, and that perhaps she would not be returning. If Mr. Dabney planned to offer her an apprenticeship, Emmy was prepared to accept, and to ask him if she might be able to sleep on the floor of his studio at night. She would not be going back to Mum's flat. Emmy didn't even want Mum to know where she was if it came to that. Emmy was not bothered that Mum would likely be furious, or even that Julia would miss her, because Julia would be safe and cared for at Thistle House for as long as the war lasted. But Emmy was bothered that she would be disappointing Charlotte. She didn't think Charlotte would be angry like Mum would be, nor even sad like Julia. Emmy was afraid Charlotte would be hurt. Emmy didn't want Charlotte to think that, after all her kindnesses, Emmy wasn't grateful. At night in her bed, Emmy would imagine what she would write in the notes that she would leave behind for both Julia and Charlotte. She would have to be vague as to where she was going, so that neither one would alert Mum to the location. And she had to communicate that it was simply wise and practical to think ahead to the life that she would live when the war was over. The time for Emmy to prepare for that life was now. The opportunity was now. There was no way for her to know whether a chance like this would come again, if it came. Mr. Dabney might not have any interest in mentoring Emmy at all. Perhaps his idea was to buy hair designs. She would not sell them. What would happen then? Would that be the end of it? Emmy refused to consider that that was all he wanted. A few more letters came from Mum. She hadn't much to tell them, and she didn't speculate on when she might come to visit, even though the Morton billeting official and Mrs. Howell had told them she was free to do so as often as she wished. Emmy wanted to believe it was because seeing them in the environment Julia had described in detail, with a lot of help with spelling, would be hard for Mum. Charlotte had provided for their every need, given them chores to do, a schedule to keep, goals to meet, and encouraged their budding talents, and she hadn't had to resort to anything disreputable to do it. The more time chipped away at August, the more restless Emmy was to hear from Mrs. Crofton. Two things happened at the end of that month. On the night of August 24th, a Saturday, the Luftwaffe dropped a collection of bombs on London, destroying several homes and killing a number of civilians. Until that Saturday night, Londoners had heard distant gunfire and seen the far-off vapor trails of dogfights in the sky over the English Channel. They had heard about the ongoing war in newspapers and on the radio, but this was the first time that London was bombed at night. Bombs fell at Aldgate, Bloomsbury, Bethnal Green, Finsbury, Hackney, Stepney, Shoreditch, and West Ham. Emmy heard on the radio the next day that fires had broken out all over London's East End, with blazes belching out of factory windows and walls crashing down as if they were made of paper. Ramsgate was also hit. 31 people were killed in the seaside city, and more than 1,000 houses were destroyed and damaged. Emmy assured Julia, who managed to hear people discussing these terrible details, despite her and Charlotte's attempts to shield her from them, that the bombs had fallen nowhere near Whitechapel, and that Mum was quite safe. For a few tense days after that, everyone waited to see what would happen next. The BBC announced that the RAF retaliated with attacks on Berlin, and then London was quiet again. Which was exactly what Emmy wanted to hear, because on September 2nd, a Monday, she received her second letter from Mrs. Crofton. "Dear Emmeline, my cousin, Graham Dabney, has at last returned to London. His father-in-law, God rest his soul, passed away 2 weeks ago. His wife is settling the last details and then taking over ownership of the house he left behind. I have some exciting news for you. At least I hope you will find it exciting. You wrote in your last letter that it would be no trouble for you to return to London to meet with my cousin about an apprenticeship. If possible, I would like you to meet me at his flat in Knightsbridge at 4 o'clock on Saturday, September 7th, so that we might discuss our idea. Bring all your sketches, dear, and do bring your mother along, too, as she will need to give her permission for what we would like to do. Running out of room in this notepaper, we'll explain all when you get here. For now, just know that my cousin and his wife and I wish to do our part in the war effort, and the protection of its youngest citizens. If you are to be evacuated somewhere, why not be with someone who can mentor you for the duration of your time away from home? Graham's address for now is 14 Cadogan Square. Safe journey, Eloise Crofton. Emmy read the letter 3 times, needing to convince herself every few seconds that she was not dreaming, and that at last her patience had been rewarded. Mr. Dabney not only wanted to mentor her, he and his wife wanted to be her foster family. They wanted to be her Charlotte. Mr. Dabney wanted Emmy to bring her sketches to a meeting in London. But they also wanted her to bring Mum, the very thought of which set Emmy's heart to skipping beats. She could not think of that now. She would not think of that now. Her only focus was getting herself to London on Saturday without anyone noticing. Chapter 14. The plan began to form in Emmy's head as she lay in bed that night. She had to be at the Knightsbridge station by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. From their travels to get to Stowe, she knew that meant she had to be on a train out of Morton no later than noon. It was an hour to Oxford, where she would have to change trains, and then an hour and a half to Paddington Station in London, and then another 20 minutes from Paddington to Knightsbridge, plus the transfer times in between. If she left any later than 12 o'clock, she would be at risk of missing the appointment. Emmy was sure there was at least one train bound for Oxford that left Morton before noon. That detail didn't cause her concern. Getting to Morton on Saturday morning without being seen was going to be the most difficult leg of the journey. There was only one way to accomplish it that she could see. She would have to sneak away in the middle of the night and walk the 5 miles to Morton in the dark. If she left at 3 in the morning, she wouldn't be seen by anyone. Not even the milkman was out and about that early. She would take only what could fit inside her satchel. Emmy estimated she would need no less than 2 hours to walk in the dark to Morton, which would put her at the train station a bit before sunrise. She would have to lie low for an hour or two, and then when the station opened, buy a ticket to London on the first train out. If everything went as planned, she would be at Knightsbridge before 1 o'clock, a good 3 hours before she was to meet with Mrs. Crofton and her cousin. All she had to do between now and then was write the 2 letters, one to Charlotte and one to Julia, and think of a way to convince Mr. Dabney that he didn't need to involve Mum, and manage to pretend for the next 3 days that nothing out of the ordinary was happening. Writing the letters was more difficult than Emmy initially thought it would be. With so little privacy at Thistle House, she'd have to write the letters by candlelight in her room, or find a quiet spot during her Friday visit to town. Since she didn't know where Charlotte kept her candles, and couldn't think of an excuse for why she wanted one, she opted to write the letters in the little triangle-shaped bit of parkland in Stowe, just across the street from Charlotte's church. Friday afternoon she left for the village right after lunch, barely saying a word to anyone, lest Julia or Rose asked to come with her. After stopping for Charlotte's newspaper, Emmy settled herself on the lone bench in the little park. She was still in view of anyone walking past, but surely she appeared as only a young woman, writing an ordinary letter to a relative or friend. Once she was settled with pen and stationery in hand, the difficulty became not finding the privacy to write the letters, but the words to put inside them. Julia's had to be worded simply, and so that she would not panic, and that proved to be the stiffest challenge. My dear Julia, I have been called away because someone very kind wants to help me make my bride's box dresses real. Just think. They won't be just drawings anymore, but real dresses. I wish I could take you with me. Truly, I do. But Mum would worry about you too much, and she would be very cross with me. I want you to stay here with Aunt Charlotte while I'm gone. She will take good care of you. Before you know it, all the children will be going back home to London, and I will come see you at the flat and show you the dresses. Won't that be lovely? Be a good girl, and mind Aunt Charlotte. The time will pass quickly, I promise. Love, Emmy. As Emmy read the letter back to herself, an ache swelled in her chest at the thought of leaving Julia, perhaps for the duration of the war. Would it be months before Emmy saw her again? Years. Would Julia forgive her for leaving her in the middle of the night? As she folded the letter and put it inside the envelope she had brought, she prayed that Julia would one day understand why it had to be this way. She printed Julia's name on the front of the envelope, and then blew the letters dry. Emmy touched the J to make sure it would not smear in her pocket, and her index finger lingered on the swirl of the letter's tail. It looked very much like the handle of an umbrella. The ache in her chest threatened to morph into something more like dread at the thought of leaving Julia behind. Emmy quickly slipped the letter into the pocket of her skirt so that she would not have to look at it anymore. Then she took the second piece of stationery and began to write. Dear Charlotte, I am so very sorry that I must return to London in a way that I am sure will disappoint you. You have been nothing but kind and generous to my sister and me, and I will always be in your debt. I have been given an opportunity to work alongside someone who can help me turn my bridal sketches into real gowns. It is an opportunity I cannot pass up. I mean no disrespect to you, and I ask that whatever feelings you have toward me for what I have done, please spare them for my sister. Please hold nothing against her because of my actions. Just watch over her and keep her safe. Thank you for everything you have done for me, and will continue to do for Julia. I hope you can forgive me. You can rest assured that I am in safe company. Yours, Emmeline Dantry. Emmy read the letter over a few times to make sure there was nothing else she could add that would lessen Charlotte's distress. She could already feel the weight of Charlotte's displeasure as she folded the letter, placed it in its envelope, and wrote Charlotte's name across the front. When the ink was dry, Emmy placed the second letter in her skirt pocket along with the first. When she got back to Thistle House, a surprising sense of melancholy swept over her as she realized that in less than 24 hours she would be gone, perhaps never to return. Ever. The war would end eventually. Julia would be sent home, and Emmy would have no need, and perhaps no invitation, to return to Thistle House. She took the stairs slowly as she went to her room to hide the letters in the bride's box for the time being. The rest of the day passed too slowly. Emmy found herself unable to concentrate on simple tasks or finish anything she started. Though she tried to project an unburdened state of mind, Charlotte asked her late in the afternoon if she was feeling all right. Flustered, Emmy answered that it was just her time of the month, and Charlotte promptly made a tea of soothing herbs that she said she used to brew for herself back in the day. Emmy thanked her and took the tea to her room to further the ruse that she wasn't feeling well. When she opened the door, Julia was sitting on Emmy's bed with a bride's box in her lap. The letter addressed to Charlotte lay open and tented near her knee, likely unread because of the cursive handwriting. The letter addressed to her, however, she held in her hand. Though Julia startled when Emmy walked into the room, guilt at being caught with a bride's box without permission, quickly evaporated into accusatory shock. Emmy could tell by her expression that Julia had read the letter. Emmy had printed the words carefully so that she would be able to do just that.
"What are you doing?"
Emmy exclaimed, though it was plain as day what Julia had been doing, and what her little sister now knew. Emmy strode toward the bed, spilling hot tea over her wrist and onto the floor. She put the sloshing cup on the bedside table and grabbed the letter out of Julia's hand.
"What have I told you about getting out the bride's box when I'm not around?"
Emmy scolded, reaching now for Charlotte's letter and the two envelopes, and scooping up the bride's box in her other hand.
"You're not supposed to get it out unless you ask me first."
Emmy's heart was pounding, and her hands shook, though she desperately willed them to stop. She stuffed the letters inside the box and snapped it shut.
"Where are you going?"
Julia's voice was whisper-thin.
"You're supposed to ask me first,"
Emmy said again, ignoring Julia's question.
"Where are you going? What's that letter for? What are you doing?"
With each question, Julia's voice got louder.
"Keep your voice down. There is nothing you need to know right now."
"Are you running away? Is that what you're doing?"
"Julia!"
"You were going to take the bride's box and leave me here, weren't you? That's what you were going to do."
"Julia, please,"
Emmy begged, all anger gone. Fear filled the empty space it left behind. She sat down on the bed next to her sister, the bride's box clasped close to her chest.
"Please keep your voice down, please."
You can't just leave me here. How can you leave me here?
Emmy laid the box down between them and gently took hold of one of Julia's hands.
Julia, listen to me. You have to trust me. Sometimes grown-ups have to do things that don't seem to make sense, and... You're not a grown-up!
Julia snatched her hand away.
Yes, I am. I'll be 16 on my next birthday. I'm not a little child anymore. I have to think of my future and what I am supposed to do with my life.
You're supposed to be with me.
Julia turned from Emmy, frowning.
Julia, look at me.
Emmy waited until Julia had turned her head back to face her.
You know how much I love my bride's dresses. You of all people know how important they are to me. I have a chance for them to become real. Some chances in life you only get once. Just the one time. I have to go.
Julia stared at the bride's box that lay between her and Emmy. Her expression was part loathing and part desire. At that moment, Emmy could see that Julia hated the brides inside that box as much as she loved them.
Take me with you,
Julia said.
I can't.
Yes, you can.
Julia, think for a moment. You are happy here. You have a lovely room. And Aunt Charlotte and Aunt Rose. You have the tea set to play with. And Guinevere and Henrietta and all their beautiful clothes. Next week school starts, and you'll get to play with all the little girls you've seen at church and in the village. You have the chickens to take care of, and the pond and the turtles. You love it here, I know you do.
A tear had formed in the corner of each of Julia's eyes.
Don't you love it here too?
Emmy moved closer and put an arm around her.
This is a lovely place, and Charlotte and Rose are wonderful people. I'm not leaving because I don't like it here. That's not it at all. If I didn't have this chance to make my dresses real, I would stay. But I have to go. Someday when you're my age, you will understand why.
I want you here with me.
And I would stay if I could, but I can't. And you will be fine here without me.
Emmy tightened her arm around her sister. For a moment, Emmy thought she had Julia convinced, but then she felt her stiffen in her half-embrace.
No. Julia, take me with you or I'm telling Aunt Charlotte.
Emmy's breath caught in her throat. She put both hands on Julia's shoulders to turn her sister toward her.
Julia, I can't take you.
Julia wriggled out of Emmy's grasp, climbed off the bed, and stood in front of her.
Take me with you, or I'm telling Aunt Charlotte right now.
Julia's gaze on Emmy was like steel.
Don't do this, Julia, please. Don't go, then. Stay here.
I have to go.
Then take me with you, or I'm telling Aunt Charlotte.
Emmy wanted to scream at her, throw something, pound the wall. She could do none of those things. She could only agree to take Julia, and then hope that when she got ready to leave in the middle of the night, Julia would not hear her, and she could steal away unnoticed.
All right, Emmy said. I'll take you.
Julia stared at her for a moment, wondering, it seemed, whether she had heard Emmy right. She had expected Emmy to tell her she would stay. That was clear.
When?
Julia asked. Very early tomorrow morning, before the milkman comes. But you can't pack anything, Julia. You can't bring your suitcase or your fairy tale book. They're too heavy. Do you understand? You have to leave those things here, and you might not see them again. I'm leaving all my things here. I'm only taking the bride's box. Do you understand what I'm saying? Julia nodded, a pensive look on her face. And you can't be looking at me strangely tonight at supper, or asking me questions or anything. You have to act like everything is normal, all right? Julia seemed deep in thought. She didn't answer.
All right? Emmy said again. I know how to be normal,
Julia said, crinkling an eyebrow. From downstairs, the girls heard Charlotte calling Julia's name. It was her turn to set the table. Julia stepped to the door and opened it.
I'm coming!
She yelled.
Not a word, Julia,
Emmy murmured.
I know how to be normal,
Julia said again, and was gone. For the rest of the afternoon and evening, Julia kept her word. She gave no indication at all that she expected to run away with Emmy that night, not even the slightest of nervous behaviors. They listened to the BBC for a little while after dinner, but there was nothing except news of air battles raging over the English Channel. Charlotte switched it off, and the four of them worked on a puzzle. Finally, a little after 9, Julia was sent up to bed, and Emmy joined her. Thinking Emmy was still having menstrual cramps, Charlotte thought nothing of it. She sent her to bed with another cup of herbal tea. Up in their bedroom, Emmy laid out on her bed what she could fit in the satchel. The coin purse that held the only money she had, all of her paycheck from her 2 months' work at Primrose, and the little bit Mum had sent with them, a package of biscuits she had taken from the pantry, changes of underwear, toothbrush and paste, and the bride's box, which she wrapped in a shawl so that the corners wouldn't bite into her side as she walked the 5 miles to Morton, with a satchel over her shoulder. The envelope inscribed with Charlotte's name she had already removed from the bride's box, and it now lay on the bed.
"What did you write in Aunt Charlotte's letter?"
Julia asked.
"The same thing I wrote in yours."
Emmy picked up the letter and set it on the nightstand, so that Charlotte would see it in the morning.
"But you have to tell her I went with you."
"She won't know I went with you unless you tell her."
Emmy had hoped Julia would not think of this, but as she stood there staring at Emmy, she knew she would have to do exactly what her sister said. Julia and she had been together every minute since she'd opened the bride's box and found the envelopes. She knew Emmy hadn't written anything additional in the note to Charlotte. Emmy decided it didn't matter. In the morning when Julia awoke, Emmy would be long gone. Charlotte would put two and two together. She would understand why in the first part of the letter, Emmy asked her to watch over Julia, and in the postscript, she told her Julia was coming along, especially since Julia would be there to fill in all the blanks.
"Get me the pen off the desk."
Julia did as she was told. Emmy retrieved the letter, lifted the single sheet of paper out, and smoothed it onto the nightstand. Underneath where Emmy had signed her name, she added, "P.S. Julie has asked to come with me." She put the note back inside its envelope and repositioned it on the nightstand. Then she told Julia to put on her pajamas.
"Why aren't we sleeping in our clothes?"
Julia said, frowning.
"Because they will wrinkle. We don't want to draw attention to ourselves, do we?"
Julia shook her head gravely. Then she changed out of her clothes, draped them on the bedpost, and hopped under the covers. Emmy had gotten into her own pajamas, and was about to crawl into bed also, when Julia sat up.
"I need a drink, Emmy. I'm too excited. I'm thirsty."
"You'll have to use the loo if you drink too much."
"Just a tiny sip, please. I won't be able to sleep if I don't have one. I'm too excited."
Sighing, Emmy got up out of bed, opened the door, and headed downstairs. Rose had already gone to bed, and Charlotte was locking the back door and turning out the lights. A wave of guilt rushed over Emmy, as Charlotte smiled at her and asked if there was anything she needed.
"Just a sip of water for Julia," Emmy said.
Charlotte laughed lightly, grabbed a juice glass from the cabinet, and filled it half full from the tap.
"That enough?"
"Perfect," Emmy said, taking it from her.
"Good night, Emmeline."
"Yes, good night. And thank you." Emmy could feel Charlotte's gaze in her as she left the kitchen. Emmy wanted badly to run from those compassionate eyes. But she walked calmly with Julia's water in her hand, took the stairs slowly, and opened the bedroom door. Julia was sitting up in bed, eager for her drink. She gulped it down in one swallow.
"Won't Mum be surprised to see us?"
Julia said as Emmy took the glass from her. Emmy stroked her sister's head. It was difficult to stay angry with her.
"Yes,"
Emmy said, unable to say anything to the contrary. She tucked Julia in.